Up. May I welcome you on behalf of the AAA Victoria to yet another of our crowded addresses. It's been a splendid attendance this year so far, and it's great to see you all here. I've got a query before we start. We have tried a new thing, or we're trying a new thing, of an advertisement in The Age, which covered three of our programs. Is anybody here as a result of those advertisements? Wow, that's really gratifying. Welcome. Now, of those who answered yes, they were here as a result of the advertisement, could I encourage them, if they're not already a member, to become a member, because we really want to build up our numbers just as quickly as we can. It's terribly important to us so that we can run programs like this in the future. So we're always on the lookout for new and interested members. That's a general invitation to everybody, but certainly to those who are here for the first time. Now, years and years ago, when I was a callow youth, and we were talking about introducing people to speak, I was told that there were a number of things that one had to do. Make sure you're covered. If you were the chairman, you were the John the Baptist. You had to launch these people so that there was an audience ready and waiting to hear what they had to say. So what you had to know was the topic, you had to know the name of the speaker, and you had to know what qualifications the speaker had to address the topic that they were to address you on. Well, I know all three of those. The topic, firstly, China taking over our world or riding for a fall. The name of the speaker, not the first time here at the AAIA, but Mr. Rowan Callick, the Asia Pacific editor of The Australian. And I suppose you're wondering what qualification he has to speak about this topic, China taking over the world or riding for a fall. Now, you may have seen the flyer that went out advertising this, and it tells you quite a lot about him and about the importance of the topic. Rowan has worked bravely in Papua New Guinea for 11 years, and he's going back, I think, next weekend, don't you?
Friday.
On Friday. We wish you the very best of luck. He was a member of Australia's National Advisory Council on Aid Policy from 1994 to 1996, a board member of the Australian Indonesia Institute from 2001 to 2006, and a member of the Foreign Minister's Foreign Affairs Council from 2003 to 2006. His book, Comrades and Capitalists, Hong Kong Since the Handover, was published by the University of New South Wales Press in 1998. He won the Graham Perkin Award for Journalist of the Year for 1995. That's a major, major award, of course. And two Walkley Awards for Asia Pacific coverage for 1997. And he followed that up with another one in 2007. So you really can't get anybody much more informed about Southeast Asia and particularly about China than Mr. Rowan Callick. So would you please welcome him?
Thank you very much. That's a bit hard to follow. John the Baptist. As a card-carrying Anglican, I don't know what to say. It's a bit speechless, really. My degree is in theology, so I've got an idea what comes next. Thank you very much. And of course, I shouldn't let it pass without being delighted that people have come here as a result of advertisements in a newspaper. It's great to be here with Consuls General from Taiwan and Croatia. Consul General. Bill Fisher, the head of DFAT in Victoria. The setting of this year for China is an interesting one. We have next week, the National People's Congress meeting in Beijing, the annual meeting of the NPC at the Great Hall of the People, at which we will get some idea about the new five-year plan, the 12th five-year plan of People's Republic, and that will tell us quite a lot about what they're aiming to do in terms of climate change, economic growth targets, and so on. So it'll set the tone for the leadership change which is coming up. It's the other big thing that we're into now. The clock is ticking for the transfer of leadership from Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao after what is now becoming a customary two terms. At the National Party Congress, the five-yearly party congress, the next one will be in October 2012. They will be replaced by Xi Jinping, a princeling, father was a famous revolutionary, and Li Keqiang. And both of them have been visited Australia in the last 18 months, so that's quite interesting. We've had a chance to see them. I've met them both. Haven't had long conversations, but I've met them both during that visit. So we're seeing the leadership change. We have the question of whether Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao will want to do anything different to set their place in history, or are they really going to limit some damage that's there. We also have the setting of two revolutions this year. We have on July the 1st, the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party inside a sort of schoolroom in the French Quarter of Shanghai, a place which some of you may have visited, is now set in a rather lurid sort of oldie world Shanghai theme park called Xintiandi, New Heaven and New Earth. And so that's the place where the 12 met. And you see in the room the picture of the waxworks of the 12 with Mao standing up, and the spotlight is on him. But of course Mao wasn't the first chairman of the party or secretary. His time came later. And on October the 10th, we have the centenary of the Xinhai Revolution. This was the revolution that saw the end of the last imperial dynasty of China. Soldiers essentially mutinied, and that led to the creation of the Republic of China. Zhongshan, Sun Yat-sen, was the first president, unanimously regarded as the founder of modern China. And the following year, the last emperor, Puyi, unforgettably for those of us who've seen the Bertolucci film, was forced to abdicate. So that's an awkward anniversary, because the Republic of China was the name taken by Sun Yat-sen's party, the Nationalists, the Kuomintang. The leadership passed to Chiang Kai-shek, and he took that name over to Taiwan in 1949 when he lost the Civil War. So Taiwan also calls itself the Republic of China. So it makes it a rather difficult anniversary in mainland China, but it's something it's going to be hard for them just to completely forget. But now that relations are not bad between China and Taiwan, it opens the door for a more proper acknowledgement of the importance of this event. Now, China ruling the world. We in Australia have come to both fear China, in my view, inordinately, and praise China inordinately. You won't be surprised to hear that my title was a trick, to trick you here. I'm not actually going to answer the question by deciding that China's going to either take over the world or collapse. My view is somewhere in between. Sorry about that. And rather dull conclusion, but I think it's the logical one. At Federation in 1901, it was China's weakness that appeared its threat. And so, of course, we, in fear of the yellow peril, decided that Chinese people would not be permitted to come and live in our country. And then and today, 100 years later, it's the strength of China that we're concerned about. And some of you may have read a report or reports of a report by strategic analyst Ross Babbage, in which he recently said that Australia should be buying nuclear submarines in order to be prepared to join a war against China, essentially, and receive some support and some disagreement. On China's part, we have People's Liberation Army, which is a body which is rapidly modernizing. The West is waiting for answers to all sorts of questions about its trajectory and indeed who ultimately calls the shots there. When recently a stealth fighter was a sort of prototype was launched during a visit of the American Secretary for Defense, Gates, it appeared that Hu Jintao was unaware of this event, leading some to conclude that the People's Liberation Army was able to run the show itself without reference to the civilian authority. Where military and civilian authorities differ is a very difficult question in China. It's not obvious. As I said, it's the party's army. People's Liberation Army owes its loyalty to the Communist Party of China and not to the Chinese state. And Hu Jintao is the chairman of the military commission. It's his second most important title. His most important title is, of course, secretary of the party. And then, incidentally, he's president of China, which is a courtesy which enables him to travel and receive due protocol. The People's Liberation Army has seen its role reinforced over the last 20 years. In 1989, when there were a lot of demonstrations relating to inflation, corruption, other issues, the army bet on firepower, and it has paid off handsomely. It reminded the party of the importance of its army, and underscored the dependability of the army to do what the party wants when the chips are down. And so that remains the case when people think of joining a sort of Jasmine Revolution or whatever in China. People think back to 1989 and wonder. Strategically, it appears that China is keen to increase its capacity to deny access to the United States, particularly to the seas on its coast. It depends heavily on trade and the import of energy. Those routes are crucial. It doesn't want to rely on the United States to keep them open and safe. And Alan DuPont said, professor at the University of Sydney, said recently that he believed they actually wanted to drive American capability into the Central Pacific. That's a concern that that sparked this sort of response from a U.S. Naval War College professor, Thomas Munkin. I interviewed about 10 days ago. He's been here in Australia. And he says that whilst China's strategic planners talk of co-opting the two island chains off the coast of Asia as a basis for maritime defence, he says, we have sovereign territories in that second island chain. The US is a Pacific power. That's part of our identity. Clearly, the Chinese are trying to undermine US influence in the West Pacific and detach us from our allies and partners. We need to be very clear-headed, understand the Chinese on their own terms as a predicate for any action on our part. He's concerned that the Chinese will take Western diplomacy and attempts to paper over differences as acquiescence. He says that would be a major mistake on both sides. And in his paper for Lowy Institute last week, he said, citing official Chinese sources, that they contrast expansionist, bellicose Western way of war with what they see as their own pacifist tradition. And he identifies four tenets of China's strategic culture. China is culturally superior. Its natural position is that of the Middle Kingdom. That it must be unified internally and free from external meddling. That war is costly and leads to eternal dissension. China's historical emphasis on territorial defence offers a caveat to Beijing's naval expansion, he says. The Navy's abilities to sustain a protracted expansion will necessarily contend with the Army's for resources. The vulnerability of China's borders with 14 countries and the threat of domestic instability. And he said it was easier dealing with the Soviet Union when that was the primary concern for the US for all those decades. And today it has Afghanistan and Iraq as more pressing military priorities. But he said China's rise is the most consequential strategic development in the world, and great powers have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. That's certainly true. And China always says that it has no ambitions spanned, but of course it does claim sovereignty over Taiwan, which is a country by any other name, and much of the South China Sea. And so that is a contested territory. But when people compare China with Germany, say, at the turn of the 20th century, and as this US Naval War College professor says, you know, he says that China can change, that it's a status quo power at present, but there's no assurance about the future. Germany was also a status quo power at the turn of the 20th century. But Germany's expansion then and in the Second World War was into new territories. China, in a way, is expanding into its own west, into Tibet and into Xinjiang, insofar as China as a nation, it's really the Han nation and the 55 so-called minorities are to the side. Economically, we are dependent on China, and so is Asia for growth, and so indeed is the world. Indeed, when Australian business talks about Asia, it talks about China. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking at a conference in Los Angeles about Australia, the US, and the US in Asia, but almost no other place got mentioned except for China. So it's a real obsession there. And I'm not going to talk a lot about China's capacity for continued economic growth. My view is that China's continued urbanization, the patterns set by other East Asian countries, which China is to an extent following, leads us to believe that it's going to be difficult to imagine that path being blocked, or China's growth pattern being dented severely. It's got a long way still to go. Its per capita gross domestic product is still only 19% of that of the United States. So each Chinese is less than one-fifth of it's making one-fifth of the productivity of an average American. But 30 years ago, when China began its economic opening, the figure was 4%. So a big rise there, and we would expect that to continue. It's still got a long way to go to catch up with its Asian neighbours as well in that regard, in per capita GDP. It's the pattern of that growth has changed a little bit. Since 2008, the year of the Beijing Olympic Games, which gave China a lot of added confidence, and the start of the global financial crisis, we've seen China shifting back to more of a planned economy. The National Development Reform Commission has gained strength. We've seen a huge fiscal stimulus program, 4 trillion kwai, 4 trillion yuan, almost 1 trillion Australian dollars paid out to revive state-owned enterprises, essentially. And we've seen the state advancing as the private sector retreat. During this time, we've seen the public service becoming the most attractive place for fresh university graduates to look for work at the expense of international companies. We've seen what Professor Shu He Ling at Monash University calls GPS dominating. He talks about GDP-centric, public sector-led, and supply-driven features of the economy. And he believes those features will continue to dominate. And partly as a result, we've seen China making it more difficult for foreign investors to enter. China's never regarded foreign companies having the right to enter the Chinese market, and it's getting increasingly difficult, which, in my view, makes our own efforts to achieve a free trade agreement much harder and makes it very unlikely. Our own investment in China at the moment is just above our investment in Luxembourg. So we do very little investing there. China's investment here is a bit more. China has invested more in Australia than any other country in the last 3 years. But it's still quite low compared with investment of other countries here, and other Asian powers have followed. It's investing a lot in extending its economic centrality to Asia. It's investing a lot in infrastructure through Southeast Asia. We're seeing a fantastic rail network built so that ultimately from Singapore you'll be able to go to Stockholm by rail. But all of these routes will go through China, of course. And we've heard talk about a bubble. I'm at the moment being asked by my editor to consider interview that an RBA director, ANU professor Warwick McKibben, talked about the likelihood of an Asian bubble, fundamentally a Chinese bubble, bursting and causing mayhem in the global economic system, worse than the GFC. But the good news for everyone is that's not going to happen. There's very little chance of that happening. There's a lot of empty flats in China. People are under no pressure to realise those assets. Banks are not interested in reclaiming the loans because they're all state-owned banks, and because of the demographic change, we're seeing wages rising very rapidly there, more than 10% a year. Wages are rising more highly than property prices. So we're not going to see a bubble burst. So that's quite good news, I think. It's most unlikely that this would happen. China's attitude to the United States, some people in China have opportunistically talked in very strong terms about the battle between the two, constriction to a sort of G2 in the world. But my view is that China really favors a slow US decline in order to prepare itself better for its own ultimate ascendancy. So it's in no rush to do so. China doesn't like the phrase. But at the same time, China's not reluctant to demonstrate a bit of hubris. When Hu Jintao was in the U.S. recently, Obama invited a young Chinese pianist called Lang Lang, who's a bit of a Liberace, actually. I'm talking about his flamboyant style rather than sexual preference. But Lang Lang, a young Chinese pianist, performed at the White House, and he played the tune from a famous film about the North Korean conflict. He didn't sing it, but the words are celebrating a victory over the Americans. So many Chinese were very entertained by this, demonstrating a bit of, in my view, tasteless hubris. Does China want to be a responsible stakeholder, which is the phrase that Bob Zelick, who runs the World Bank, prescribed? That was a role that was prescribed for it by Zelick, and indeed by our own foreign minister, Kevin Rudd. My view, China has no interest in fulfilling that expectation, and we saw that in Copenhagen at the climate change conference, and we've seen that in the G20. A lot of people, including, of course, our sainted foreign minister, views that G20 is a towering achievement, but it's a process. It's not really an end, and that process is already flailing, in my view, and China's very reluctant to see G20 require things like a change in exchange rate and so on, interest rate of the members. And at the last meeting in Paris of finance ministers, it again stymied any real resolution. Doha, similarly, we'll see what happens. We're in the last few months. If Doha, the WTO's latest round, if that after 10 years is going to eventually get over the line or not, it will depend very heavily on China and the USA, of course, to do so. And China's, in the meantime, prefers to choose its own interventions. It's intervening in different places, in Greece, Portugal, and so on, over the semi-collapse we're seeing in the Eurozone. And obviously, there are conditions for such bailouts, which only become apparent later. It's even talked in the last few weeks about Taiwan joining its new five-year plan, very kindly offering Taiwan a place in that plan. What are China's real ambitions? Deng Xiaoping said, "Bide your time, don't take the lead, seize opportunities when they come." And that remains a position that quite a lot of people in the leadership quite like, but at the same time we're seeing people take a more assertive and nationalist line. So this is a contested space at the moment. Richard Rigby, who's the who was a former diplomat and runs a China school at the ANU, says that really what China wants is, it wants leaders in this region to wake up wondering, what will China think? Very nice way of putting it. It wants to be central in to the minds of people, when of decision makers, when they make those decisions. Very important, this one, that China's focus will continue to be domestic. The legitimacy of the party continues to be constantly at stake. The members, the leaders, worry all the time, despite having 62 years of power. They worry all the time about its legitimacy. And it was based really after the Cultural Revolution, and Deng came to the fore and opened the economy. It was really based on the continued delivery of improved living standards. But now, now people have got a bit blasé about the living standards going up, and so it's extended beyond that to safety and security. The party provides safety, security, stability, and we see a big emphasis on the joblessness in America, on the penury of Europe in comparison with China, rolling in money, apparently. And we see whenever there's a natural disaster, we see the People's Liberation Army to the fore. The GFC has been something of a watershed in the eyes of the world about China's role. It's obviously dented American prestige, and the Chinese authorities have made sure that their own citizens are well aware of the way the rest of the world now looks much more to China. It was clear from my recent visit to America that Barack Obama is returning to an Asia focus. It was interesting that people noted that on recent visits to India and Indonesia, he talked there about shared values. And socially, we see China playing a huge, starting to influence life, starting to lead a debate. I don't know if any of you have heard of a book by Amy Chua about how to bring up kids. She talked about tiger mums, and I interviewed Li Chunxin, the writer of Mao's Last Dancer, about this, who was less convinced by about Amy's rigorous way of bringing up children, in which there were no sleepovers, no TV, no computer games, only long, long sessions of hard work and learning piano or violin. So this sort of debate, anyway, whatever you think of the debate, but the fact that, and she's not Chinese, she's actually American, she was born in America, but she identifies as culturally Chinese. It's interesting to see, and I think is part of this this rise of China. Is China really riding for a fall? Since the opening, every next reform has been said to be one bridge too far, people have said. And I remember when I was... I've twice been a China correspondent, the first time when I was for the Financial Review. And at that time, people were saying the reform of state-owned enterprises, clearly moribund, was going to be too hard. Vested interests would not be budged. Zhurongji, the then premier, wouldn't be able to do it. But he pulled it off. And constantly we see what I think is a rather commendable motto. Deng Xiaoping's favourite phrase of mine is, development is the irrefutable argument, which is part of that question of how the party gets its legitimacy. And of course you can set that phrase over and against Western querulousness about economic growth today, and you see the vitality of China and Asia. No doubt development is the irrefutable argument. And they, I believe, will pull off the next ones. But they get harder. They do get harder. So we've got to reform the finance sector. Services as a whole has been preserved for the Chinese state-owned sector. We haven't seen foreign enterprise come into the services sector as it has into manufacturing. Mostly the foreign involvement in China has been restricted to manufacturing. So the finance sector is important to move. Urbanization itself remains a challenge. The move away from a reliance on export to domestic economy, as all advanced economies have, increasing role for services, and demography, a big challenge. The workforce is going to peak in 4 years, and then we're going down the other side because we've got we've had a one-party system, one-party families in urban China anyway, one-child families in urban China anyway, and then we're going to those one children, those single children, having to look after the results of Mao's populate or perish, all the aunties and uncles, big lines of them. So by 2050, 31% of the country will be over 65 years old. So they need to make the capital work for them as well. And that compares with what will probably still then be a youthful United States. Environment, of course, many problems there, many issues, including an interesting one. The aquifers in northern China are being depleted at a terrific rate, and that is a recipe for trouble down the track as the Gobi Desert keeps moving south. But they've worked up quite an effective sequencing of growth, the use of when they want to, of international treaties, like the accession to the WTO was used as a lever to achieve some change at home. We've seen them at the other end using pilots, and so they do things in a city or a province, and then they go national with it. And to an extent, as Chinese ambassadors here have said to me, Australia is a pilot, is a testing ground for Australian relations with Western countries. We have the challenge of immense credit. 200% of GDP is out on loan. But as I said, it's not. No one's really calling for the money back, so it's not such a big issue. Now, then, China's popularity in the rest of the world is up and down, and it's been down recently. It's not only the US, but other countries in developing countries are upset by currency manipulation. Brazil has complained about it, and the Asian neighbours are mostly back in the United States fold. Jufeng, a professor at Beijing University, described to me on a visit here a year or two ago, he described China as a lonely rising power, not any friends amongst those 14 countries around. An opportunity for Australia to at least take China seriously, and there are opportunities there for us. It has increasing challenges. It's facing increasing challenges to its doctrine of non-interference. Its important relations with countries like Burma, Sudan, Pakistan, North Korea, how much does it get involved, and how much when it gets involved, is that going to cause it trouble? There's a very nice paper by Kerry Brown and Lo Su Xing, Chatham House paper, in which they say, a very nice description, China's unclear narrative leads it into apparently contradictory actions and positions. It claims to champion developing countries, but expects to be treated as one of the major powers. It joins multilateral organizations, but is unyielding on its national interests. It speaks of its harmonious rise, but flexes its military muscle. It wants to be seen as a strong country, but plays on its history of victimization. I quite like that characterization. It provides quite a challenge for its diplomats, who themselves have found it difficult to be heard in the current noisy environment, as we see the shift in power taking place at the moment in Beijing. Joseph Nye, who was the guy who invented the phrase soft power, American professor who was for a while recently ambassador to Japan, says even if China suffers no major domestic political setback, many current projections are based simply on GDP growth. They ignore US military and soft power advantages as well as China's geopolitical disadvantages in Asia. America is more likely to enjoy favorable relations with its neighbors, allies like Europe and Japan, as well as India and others. My best estimate is that among the range of possible futures, the more likely one is one described by Lee Kuan Yew as China giving the US a run for its money, but not passing it in overall power in the first half of this century. And Korean thinker Kim Jin-hyun says similarly. He says, and he comes at it from a rather personal view, a rather interesting one. He says, I haven't met an individual in the East or West who wants to live in China permanently, although many people want to visit China for business or sightseeing. Though there is an exception. There's a friend of mine named Ted Rule, who was Australia's first commercial attaché, or whatever you want to call it, in Beijing when we opened the embassy in the late 70s. And was it late 70s? Was it after that? Yeah. And Ted is now living in Shenzhen, just over the border from Hong Kong, and is having quite a good life there. So there are people who've sort of migrated to China, but it's a rather unusual situation. So people within China, part of the problem of the party, and one of the reasons why it's trying to extend the reasons for its legitimacy beyond the merely economic, is that people are starting to take economic success for granted. People who've been born since 1980 have grown used to having material things, and they are starting to think, well, maybe we need more say. We want less corruption, and they raise quite a few questions. And they've started to They also demonstrate a bit of a lack of trust in the capacity of China to order its own productive sector. And so, very interestingly, at the start of Chinese recent Chinese New Year, which we're still in the period. Have we finished the Chinese New Year period, Calvin? It's just finished. At the start of this period, the stores in Hong Kong were emptied of formula, of baby milk, and of a lot of well-known pharmaceuticals by Chinese tourists who went over there during Chinese New Year. Now, before they've bought jewelry and other things, But this time they're buying all sorts of provisions that they don't trust their own brands. So this is an interesting issue, I think. So Hong Kong, I know this because one or two Hong Kong friends of mine were pretty cheesed off with this, but they're benefiting a lot from all these tourists coming anyway. So and there are governance issues, difficult ones. The rule of law remains completely untouched. But of all these questions tend not to be addressed so much by if people most of the contact that we have with, say, Chinese students working studying in Australia is with people whose background is a little bit different. A friend of mine at RMIT University who teaches translation and interpreting set at the end of last year people in this group, it's a postgrad group, to translate a few pages from a book written by the ABC shock jock John Fain about his some travels he did. And the book, he travels through China apparently, so he has some questions about the environment or something. And my friend was quite stunned when she found that the third paragraph, the student had written across the top of this paragraph, "Politically contentious material, skip." And then the next page, again, a paragraph was crossed out, "Politically contentious material, skip," and so on. And so this went through. So she failed the student, but then the student appealed to the professor. The professor said, "Oh, no, that's quite legitimate because this is the student's cultural right to not to be forced to read things that are too upsetting." So quite, I mean, that says a lot in itself. There's something a bit different. But we see a smooth transition in the party leadership in China, and the transition is taking place through what is essentially the new style of leadership, not a charismatic leadership, but a leadership of committee men. And I use the word men because no woman has ever been on the Politburo Standing Committee since 1949, or before, of course. So none of the top 9 or 10 governing China have ever been a woman. So, essentially we see committee men, people who run by consensus. They're making sure the factions, the army and so on, are all on board. It makes decisions a little more difficult. It means change comes harder and decisions take longer to make. And at base, though, so I think, yeah, we see, a good example of this. Zhu Feng, whom I quoted before, recently wrote quite a good article in which he said he talked about how this impacts international affairs. He said, "The irony is that Chinese dithering has incited Cold War-type concerns in South Korea, Japan, and the US." So the word, the dithering really is a result of being run by committee men who have to balance all sorts of interests and concerns and are reluctant to ultimately make decisions. Corruption, I shouldn't finish without mentioning. Corruption remains an issue which concerns ordinary people. A lot of money is diverted. A recent report on the grey economy reckons that as much as 30% of the economy is that the economy is actually 30% more than people officially report, and that 30% is grey areas, we would call semi-corrupt or corrupt areas, And that helps explain why where I've lived in Beijing, fellow residents of the apartment building where I was living were Chinese people with apparently very small incomes, but with very lush lifestyles. So there's a lot of money in the grey economy. This ethos of corruption is captured in this popular song, which is titled, "I Want to Marry a Government Official." And it says, he has power, a car and a house. He only needs to drink tea and read the newspaper during work. He never spends his own money on cigarettes and alcohol. He can get free food every day. He can get promoted just by kissing his boss's ass. So, you know, this is so this is a sort of view that a lot of people have and concerns people. And not everyone's corrupt in China, of course. And a lot of decent people are trying to work out how to squeeze it out of the system. But in my view, when you have an unaccountable one-party state, it's very difficult to remove corruption. But at base, in our area, Asians view China's success with pride, in my view, overall. And its economic success remains intact, far ahead of India's, for example. We just need to hope that this continues because our own economic success is substantially predicated on this. The last thing I want to say is the long term and the short term. As I said, China's run by a committee man, and increasingly decisions are made based on the short term, not on the long term. And people who deal with Chinese companies know that many state-owned enterprises have quite short time horizons to achieve things or not. There's a sort of myth built in the Western world that China looks far ahead, you know, that it's a nation of Confuciuses. And people, I've heard many times at conferences with names like Dragon Rising, this type of name, people talking about Zhou Enlai, the premier during all of Mao's time, that Zhou Enlai was asked about what he thought about the French Revolution. And he said, "It's too soon to tell." So this is a favorite answer used by business people here and in Western countries. Actually, that's not true. I always thought it was a strange thing, but recently, after researching this with people who were around at the time when Nixon and Kissinger first went to China and when this conversation happened, what actually he was being asked about was the not the French Revolution of 1789, but the revolutionary behaviour in France in 1968 and the years afterwards, which makes a lot more sense. And so is this truly communist? You know, the Debray and Danny the Red and so on in the on the streets of Paris. Is that truly revolutionary? And he said, too soon to tell, because it was only 4 years afterwards. I think that makes a lot of sense. So we need to find out more about China. Okay, that's all. Thanks very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got time for just a couple of questions, so please be succinct. No speeches, just a quick question, and then we'll deal with that. Over here.
Good day. Thank you for coming and giving a great talk. My name's Guy Roberts. I'm actually a PhD student at Melbourne Uni, so please make your answers detailed. Two questions. Firstly, how do you rate the power of the CCP to push out its reforms on local branches all over the country? And secondly, and this is the question I'd like lots of details on, how do you think George Bush handled the US-China relationship? Thanks.
I'm not a great expert on the George Bush years, Most American presidents do the same thing. They start off by emphasizing the differences, human rights, and so on, and then the business lobby and realism sets in, and then they quite soon start to realize we need to do business with these guys, and so there's quite a degree of complementarity as well. Of course, we've seen in his years the imbalance started to accelerate to the situation which we have now, and a lot of people blame the Americans and praise the Chinese for saving, but of course they haven't chosen to save. The ordinary people of China have had money stolen from them, in effect, by the state-owned enterprises who've been the government has required savings by depressing wages. That's changing now because of the demography and other things. So Bush himself had quite a good relationship. The China sent as ambassador to Washington a guy who was a friend of the family and knew the dad and so on. And your first question was about the role of the CCP. Well, there's lots of ways that they do it. I've just written a long article about party schools, and that's one way. There's 2,000 party schools in China, about the same as non-party tertiary institutions. They're unbelievably well-resourced education institutions, probably the best in the world, in my view, in terms of hardware and mostly fantastic new buildings. And cadres are required to spend quite a lot of time, and state-owned enterprise executives, of course, who are cadres as well. So the people who are working in Western Australia sometimes just have to say, well, the next month I'll be in the party school in Pudong or wherever that they're assigned to go. And these party schools are quite effective about bringing change. Generally, I would say, they are on the smaller liberal side of the party and tend to bring in some new ideas. And I think they've been quite a good influence. But, of course, at base, we have the problem that of how officials are rewarded, which is what matters, massively they're rewarded by how much economic growth happens or they can ascribe to their areas of responsibility. And so we have big clash there with environmental issues and issues relating to land ownership and so on. And so until they change the way in which people are rewarded, I think there's always going to be a clash.
Sorry? I got you there.
Hi, Joanne Morgan. At the moment, I was talking about demographics, at the moment there's 105 Chinese men for every 100 Chinese women, and that's at marital age. Apparently, at present, at birth, there's 121 boy children being born for every 100 girl children. That's due to sex-selective abortion. My question is to do with, you were saying, with the strategic thinking of China, that the fourth tenet was that war is costly and for the 10%. My question is, if there are so many men in China in 20 years or so that cannot find wives, will it possibly be an option for the Chinese government to then focus outwards to minimise in terms of percent?
People have worried about this. I think so far they feel the best thing is to push these people into the West, go West, young man. And I think this is what they see the West as empty, and comparatively Xinjiang and Tibet are. And, Yunnan, Guizhou, Gansu, all those places are out there. They figure that there's a bit of space that they can push people into. And in the previous generations, they formed, I forget the Chinese word, a brigade they sent to Xinjiang. And people are still being invited to go there. So I think to an extent they'll try to encourage them to populate those areas with Han so that the Han become a clear majority in those places first. Will they go to war? They're very worried about going to war because the history of Chinese regimes which have gone to war is that they tend to... there's regime change during or after a war. The Kuomintang clearly, in my view, would still be governing China if Japan hadn't invaded and if they hadn't fought. While the Kuomintang were fighting the Japanese, the communists were gathering their strength and so on. So I think would they do this in order to solve this demographic riddle? I don't think so. But I don't know really what the answer is. The answer is actually to relax the one-child policy, and they've been talking about that for some time. It is relaxed in the countryside and amongst minorities, but not in the urban area. Though Shanghai is starting to say you can have two now. And in other places, you can pay a fine equivalent to the cost of bringing up an extra child. So where I was living, people had three or four children. They just paid, 30 or 40,000 a year, and it wasn't a problem for them. But it's a tragic situation for, of course, and will cause great social dislocation for some time to come because those solutions won't answer that the generation now being born. It's a problem.
A quick one.
Hi, I'm Fraser, member and former council member. Something that hasn't been touched on tonight, obviously, of big importance is China bringing to space. Do you have any idea in the next 15, 20 years where this is heading?
Well, they're really excited about it. It's a really big part of this prestige thing, and they're putting a lot of money into the space program. And I think that their first aim is to have in orbit, and then beyond that, the moon. But I don't know what timescale they've got to achieve this. But Chinese people, generally, I've said this here before. Chinese people, in my view, admire Americans. They like Americans individually because Chinese people are very individualistic people, like the Americans. And there's on a personal background, in a personal respect, they like to do things the American way. And I think they feel that that is the path they want to follow. And if you want to be a superpower, you have to be in space. So you're right.
Well, this is a bit of a tragedy, really, because I know that Rowan has covered such a huge amount of material here today, and everybody's got some questions, and I've got lots, and I'm not going to ask them now. You'll be glad to know. But we do finish at 7, so it's my very pleasant duty to move a vote of thanks to Rowan, because what we've heard is a very detailed exposition of a whole lot of areas that people would want to know about in relation to China and what's happening there. I think we're all very lucky when we come to the Institute to hear speakers of this calibre with the detailed knowledge which they can impart to us. I don't know really where to start in the thanking because there's so much there. China is superiors. China is the Middle Kingdom. Unified internally, war costly and leads to internal dissension, as you said, and this sort of stuff is very good for us to know. What I was pleased to hear him say and emphasise, we are not going to have a bubble burst. That's important for Australia and Australians.
We've got really...
Development is the irrefutable argument. Perhaps we could convince some of our governments about that as well. But the one that really stuck in my mind was this, that the workforce will peak in 4 years. That is an incredible statistic, and the demographic changes that are going to take place in China after that are really going to be worth watching. So, Rowan, you've covered a great number of areas in fine detail. Thank you very much indeed. It's not your first visit here, and I promise you, you'll get other invitations. So would you join with me in thanking you? tastes slightly different than Mao Tai. Thank you very much indeed, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. The meeting is closed.